two terms throughout the time that I'm with you, and because these two terms are, I think, important in all discussions of the kind we're engaged in, we better get the difference straight. I hear them constantly confused. We talk about ecology, and we also talk about environment. And people say, we must do something about the ecology. You can't do anything about the ecology. Ecology is a word that points simply to the structure of things, the given relations and interrelations of things in virtue of their being at all. The world, the cosmos, is ecologically structured. You can defy the ecology, or you can be in harmony with the ecological structure of things. But about ecology as such, you can do nothing at all. Environment means the theater of man's life, which of course involves his acknowledgement of the ecological structure of nature and of human life. About that he can do a great deal. He can by action, by will, by reflection, he can make his environment more obedient to the fundamental ecological structure or less obedient. He can mount an assault upon the ecological structure of things to his catastrophic outcome, or he can acknowledge the givenness of things and prosper. But you can't do anything about ecology. You can do a great deal about environment. Now, you may suppose that because I've been up to the neck in this kind of thing for so long, I have a couple of lectures I'll simply dig out. That isn't true. I have to put the thing together for myself over and over and over again as a Christian theologian who's concerned with the environment against the reality of the ecological structure of things. I have to think this over always afresh, because the nature of the environment and man's transactions with it are always undergoing the impact of new data, the disclosure of new ecological realities, and the consequent environmental disasters or good things, so that there is no such thing as a kind of final word about this. And I'm going to try to do with you this morning something I've really never tried before, and I do it this way as a kind of gesture of respect for you. I don't think it's necessary in a group so constituted that I should go over what you already know. That is, the appalling facts of the deterioration in the environment, the appalling ignorance that exists in the public generally, nor do I have to tell the sad tale which is summed up in the most appalling of all statistics, that in North America, with 6% of the world's population, we consume about 42% of the non-reproducible resources. So I shall simply not talk about the statistics of oil and water and air and so forth, except for an occasional illustration, but simply assume that the facts of the matter are clear. That is, I think they're clear to you. I do not think even the facts are very clear generally. If they were clear, one would suppose that the report of the auto industry last spring that the increasing percentage of cars that were being bought were small and efficient, that corner has now turned and the dealers are rejoicing in the fact that people are flocking back to the big 8-cylinder gas hogs. So I don't think people really dig or understand very clearly what we're up to. But in this company, I shall assume that you really do understand what ecology is and are aware of the kind of statistical confirmation of a coming catastrophe that we all confront. But as a Christian theologian, I also am fairly mordant about the prospect of any early change, because not only by the insights of Christian theology, but also by experience in world history, it's quite clear that millions of men and women can walk straight into an obvious disaster with their eyes wide open when their desires are strong. If we really want something enough, it is a sign of original sin, I suppose, that we can walk straight into catastrophe with our eyes wide open in order that our concupiscence, our desires, our lusts may be fulfilled. And that seems to be the present state of the situation. Now, I take my start this morning in a way I didn't intend to. This is a kind of illustration of the fact that you should always have breakfast alone before you have to make a speech. Because at breakfast this morning, I sat with a young woman I met outside the dining hall, and she asked me a question which caused me to reflect upon something I had never reflected upon before. And out of those reflections, I tossed aside my notion of how I would begin this, and I'm substituting another off the cuff. This woman asked me, how did you happen to become interested in the environment and also in gaining knowledge about the ecological reality of the world? How did you happen to get interested in this in the first place? Now, all the way up the hill, I thought of that. In fact, my cerebrations were so enormous that I fell on my duff on the ice, but not sufficiently strongly to discombobulate what I want to say. So I want to try to answer that girl's question, because it's not only a question. If I answer the question well, it will also provide a way in which any intellectual discipline works. Any intellectual discipline, including theology, if it really investigates how and by what route it comes to a certain opinion, judgment, statement, begins unraveling, which process is pretty much like peeling an onion. It goes back and back and back and discloses more and more elements, often undetected by the holder of them, elements which have actually been constitutive of the way he thinks or the way he feels. Now, she caused me to acknowledge that, first of all, she was right. I have had, so far as my memory goes, a lifelong interest in the environment, and have been active in lately, that is for the last 25 years, in certain actions about it, but I had never really tried to unravel the interior structure of an obvious interest. I suggest for your own enlightenment someday, each of you tries to do that for himself. You'll learn a great deal about what one might call the symbiotic nature of reflection. That all reflection is a symbiosis. Many things flow together to constitute a position or are constructive of a judgment. So I'm going to try off the cuff, as fully as I can, to answer that question, not as a kind of personal exercise in recollection, which is really could be done in solitude, but because it will prepare you, I think, too, for the theological constructive talk that I want to make later today. So this morning will be an exercise in trying to get a lot of stuff face up on the table and then putting it together in what I believe to be a theologically constructive suggestion for the doctrine and teaching of the church. And for all of us who are members of it, I will try to do that this afternoon. As I try to detail these components, they will have only the order in which my memory recaptures them. The first and second and third are not matters of importance, but only sort of chronological. I suppose that the presence in my grade school of an extraordinary teacher was one of the most important components. An extraordinary woman who taught us English literature, and even at the beginning of this century, when language was much more honored in its opulence and its sensitivity than it is now, even at that time, the linguistic sensitivity of a 12-year-old is not remarkable, I think. But she was a remarkable teacher. And I think the way that woman exposed us in the classroom, particularly to the great nature language and nature poetry of the 19th century, I think it had a profound impression on me. I was not aware that I loved poetry until much later, but she made me aware of that magic in language, whereby an evanescent or fleeting or obscure perception can be, by the miracle of language, brought to concretion. For instance, how many of us have enjoyed the early days of October? And you know, there is something, Thomas Wolfe loved to talk about it, there is something magic about the coming of autumn. But until it finds, as Shakespeare says, a local habitation and a name, till somebody catches it in language, that which has been a kind of subterranean rejoicing floats around without a habitation, without any concretion. So that I recall that I'm sure much too uninformed to have appreciated the greatness of what I was hearing and learning, but I remember that I was struck then, and I remember still the opening lines of John Keats's Ode to Autumn, season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run. I did not then know, as George Saintsbury later taught me, that is probably the greatest single poem in the English language. But this concretion in language of a common subterranean perception, this, in a sense, related me to the natural world in such a way that, having sensed one thing in virtue of that concretion, the spirit is open to a deepening sensitivity and perception of everything else, so that one could pass from that particular thing to Wordsworth's haunting lines when he's talking really about the experiences of childhood and what it means in maturity to grow beyond and leave behind, often with sadness, the unrecapturable impressions of early childhood. Now, you remember, some of you, the lines, I think, on Intimations of Immortality. There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. And then he ends, it is not now as it hath been of yore, the things which I have seen I now can see no more. Well, that does not have to happen that way. If one early is taught to see, to behold, even if this comes, it does not have to come by the way of language or poetry. But it may come that way, and in my case, it did, because I think I'm, by structure, a highly verbal person. Another way, another component that early constituted what the biologists would call the morphology of my mind. Because I think the fact that I have a defective spirituality, I'll let me put that as clearly as I can, because that's a fatal statement for a Lutheran. but in my case, it's a very true one. That is, I have never been able to understand what people mean by spirit apart from a certain vitality which is inseparable from material things. I remember how in college, when I first had my first course in philosophy, what an enormous release I felt, because I had been brought up in a Southern Ohio ethos in which people talked eagerly and openly in pietistic language about the Holy Spirit and the Spirit all the time, and I frankly didn't know what the devil they were talking about. So it was a kind of release when I read in Santayana, there is nothing spiritual that does not have a material root, and there is nothing material that does not have a spiritual possibility. That is, this impossibility of spirit without a material embodiment, and this impossibility of looking at anything material without sensing that there are interior dimensions of meaning within it which escape purely material description. This double thing, which I have called a defective spirituality, whereby I always had to probe the material for what is it saying about God and man and the cosmos, the nature of human life? What is the process or the pattern that is disclosed here? The exquisite form of a flower or a leaf, is it simply a piece of geometry or a piece of natural engineering? Well, it is that. But I always ask, following that insight, I always ask the great question of Chesterton. Why does God make the grass an endurable green? You know, green, as every artist knows, is a color that can be taken in indefinite amounts without perturbation. Red will drive you mad if there's too much of it. But you can take green in an indefinite amount. Why does God make the grass a lovely green and not an intolerable red? And Chesterton goes on, I have always loved the steeliness of steel and the unutterable muddiness of mud. Now this instant affection for the shapes and the colors and the textures of things, this affection which also evokes admiration and wonder, is a kind of entree, as it were, into a suspicion that God the Creator is involved in, permeates the acts of his creation. He does not simply create and throw out apart from himself, but the reality of the Creator inheres also in the things that he has made. It was much later that I found out, against the protest of my theological teachers, that Luther also taught the same thing. So that if the Creator invests himself, as it were, not absolutely, otherwise we would need no revelation, but God does relate himself, and something of the reality of the Creator is in the creation. And then, being a Trinitarian theologian, the reality of God the Son cannot disclose the reality of the Father except by being a son of man, except by doing his thing where we are, not just throwing it like a stone, but the Word became flesh, that is, the ultimate spirit became enfleshed, interestingly, not as an angelic or seraphic reality, but as Mary's son. And then I would suggest to carry the Trinitarian doctrine right on through, that the reality of creation, redemption, the reality of sanctification discloses itself by our honoring the God who inheres in things, who became the noblest of these things, the human reality, in order to disclose himself. So this second component was what I've called a defective spirituality, where I was not willing to see the Spirit as a kind of holy gas, as it were, or a kind of balloon of spirituality floating out there. But unless it became present, concrete, as a possible dimension of ordinary realities, it remained elusive, in fact, incomprehensible to me. And I suppose that's why, very early in my life, along with the training in literature, whereby literature's marvelous precision in bringing things forward in name, this helped constitute what one might call an interest in the ecological structure of things. A third interest, I think, is a kind of inborn suspicion of all substantial thinking. Now, by that I mean something that people here in the natural sciences will understand. Let me just deal with one of them. Contemporary physics no longer talks about things being located here or here or here. The natural world is apparently constituted by energies, so that the language of energy and motion and relation is the only language that contemporary physics uses. They do not any longer talk about atoms or molecules in terms of substances with a simple location. Things are what things do. That is, the energetic output or the molecular arrangement whereby the energy takes this form instead of that. That's the fundamental language, more or less, of the biological sciences too. And it's very interesting that in the Eastern Church, the theologians of the Eastern Church use a phrase which never gained currency in the Western Church. See, we, because of an Aristotelian philosophical tradition, we tended to talk about being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made. We used substantial language. We talked about the attributes of God, as if God were a pie that could be cut up into pie-shaped sections called omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, and so forth. That is a kind of theological language which is indebted to thinking of reality as substantial. But the Scripture doesn't talk of reality in substantial terms. It talks of ultimate realities are relations. And the Greek Orthodox phrase, the energies of God, is a fascinating one, particularly for the mind trained in contemporary science, that God is talked of fundamentally as energetic, that energia, that erg is a phrase that comes from that, a term for energy. This kind of language is much more appropriate to both contemporary science and particularly to biblical speech. Let me illustrate that. What is love? Love is not a substance. Love is a function of a relationship. Hate is a term used to describe a fractured, broken, alienated relationship. Look at the words in the Bible, redemption, restoration. We are restored, that is, put where we belong. To be in the right relationship to God is not some new thing added to your personhood. It is the recovery of the intended personhood. So that the whole biblical language uses the words relation, relational terms for fundamental realities. I have an illustration of this which occurred to me only a few years ago. I was at an LWF meeting in Jerusalem, and we had an afternoon off, and I wanted to go see a former student who had a parish in Ramallah, about 30 kilometers up the dusty road from Jerusalem. And I had no way to get there, so I borrowed a car from the assistant pastor at the church there, and it was a beat-up old Ford. And about 3 miles out of town, it started to cough and miss, and I had a suspicion of what was wrong. So I went into a gas station and asked the Sabra, a young Hebrew lad who'd grown up in Israel. I told him what the symptoms were and said, "Can you locate what the trouble is? I think it's the air cleaner." Well, he took the air cleaner off and doused it in whatever they douse it in, and then he took the top of the distributor cap off and took a cloth and wiped the points clean and took the carburetor, ran a pipe cleaner through the air intake in the carburetor, and with a typical American just said, "Step on it." And I did, and it went right off. Then he used the word, he said, "Tzedek." And then it hit me. Tzedek is the Hebrew word for righteousness. To be right, to be righteous with God, that is tzedek in Hebrew. Tzedek means that you are restored to, you are in the relationship that God meant for you. Righteousness is not fundamentally a moral word. That follows. It's fundamentally a geometric word. It means that the pegs go into the holes they are meant to fit. So that to be righteous means to be in the right, proper, meant relationship. So when the carburetor was doing its thing properly, he said, "Tzedek, you've got a righteous carburetor." Well, a righteous man is therefore not accounted for by saying, does he obey this law and that law, and does he know all the right things to do? Now, he may know all that. But fundamentally, righteousness is an interior appropriateness to the holy constitution of man, to the holy constitution of the world. Now, all that kind of stuff in the head over the years has accumulated, and I suppose it came to a kind of precipitate in the early 50s in my career, when as a practicing theologian in the church, I became aware of two things. First, that man's transactions with the natural world had achieved an appalling efficiency. I use the word appalling because this efficiency, unattended by a clear plan or acknowledgement of the nature of the environment, could be a catastrophic thing. I became aware of that. The second place, I became aware that my task as a theologian was not just to transmit the accepted theology of the church, though one could make a career out of doing just that, in fact, a much more peaceful career doing just that, than trying to do theology over and over and over again in terms of the passing situation. So I asked myself, where is it Is there anywhere in our Lutheran theological tradition anything which peculiarly prepares my own communion, the Lutheran company? What have we got to say before an environmental catastrophe? And I began to scrounge through my theological inheritance, and I found very little. I found that we had nothing distinctive, so I thought, nothing distinctive, characteristic, accented in our tradition, whereby to confront man's rapacity toward his world. And then I thought, well, of course, all theology is not created by the theologians. In fact, the operating theology of most people comes through liturgy and hymnody, I'm convinced. I think you ask the ordinary person in our congregations what he thinks about God, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, he's much more liable to quote you a hymn or a liturgical sentence or a prayer than something from Martin Heineken or S.A. Schmucker or Charlie Jacobs, you know, or St. Augustine, to put Heineken in very good company. He was much less likely to do that. So I went through all the hymns in the book. I found exactly five that had even the most oblique reference to man's self-awareness of the Christian faith, which had any ecological dimensions, any dimensions of acknowledging his situation as part of the creation. Now, there was plenty of pious talk about being poor worms and groveling sinners and a lot of that, but it never came clear. It never came clear that man is constituted by his relationships. And that's my fourth point as to the components of my present deep interest in this matter. And let me talk some more about it. Let's just take the phrase that man is constituted by his relationships. That, on the face of it, is simply self-evident. If someone asks you who you are, you begin to answer the question by pointing not to any internal substance. You don't, you know, as we often do in certain meditational habits, gaze at your navel long enough and try to find your identity. This elusive identity and this identity search, in my judgment, is the reigning heresy of your generation. This assumption that if you gaze into solitude fixedly enough, you'll find out who you are. Because what you are is not there. We are constituted by our relations. The Germans have a beautiful proverb, Ein Mensch ist kein Mensch. A solitary man or person is no person. Someone asks you who you are, the first thing you say, well, my father was so-and-so, my mother was so-and-so, I went to school so-and-so, I grew up so-and-so, I came under the influence. What you do is give a relational answer to a substantial question. The question, who are you, is simply not conceivable, let alone answerable, except by referring to the web or the matrix in which your identity has received, to be sure, a configuration that may be quite clearly your own, but its substance is by no means a solitary thing. When I was describing for you how I came to be sensitized to the bewitching variety of the natural world, I did not dig this from myself. I owe it to John Keats and Coleridge and Wordsworth and Gerard Manley Hopkins and a lot of other people. and to find teachers, and to a man in my father's old congregation into whose shop I used to like to stop on the way home from school. He was a leather worker. And as I saw that man with his hand smooth out the leather and feel the difference between one kind of leather and another. And then when I saw a woodworker in my father's parish repairing something, pat the altar rail when he finished repairing it with an almost affectionate personal gesture. These things taught me that we are constituted by wood and wind and air and animal life and the products of this world, both natural and fabricated. Well, I think I better move on now to something transpersonal and historical. I want to account now, if I can, and insofar as I can, that will only be a certain distance, insofar as I can, I want to account for the strange lethargy or absence within our Lutheran inheritance of something one might expect to be there. Because we are a Catholic church. The whole Catholic tradition was not repudiated by us, but rather reformed by our reformers. Why so much of that tradition has failed to enter into contemporary Lutheranism was a question I had to ask myself. And I begin by recalling to you an essay which many of you must have read if you've done any work in environmental studies or inquiries at all. It was about 5 years ago, wasn't it, the first Earth Day celebrated in all the schools, and a little paperback with a group of very nugatory little essays came out. One of them was by Barry Commoner, who later wrote that fine book, The Closing Circle. One of them was by the man who wrote The Law of the Commons. And another one, the first essay, was probably the most memorable one by a man at the University of California called Lynn White. Some of you in sociology or economics might have read White's very influential book called Technology and Society, in which he uses he points to profound, often simple technological changes as having enormous social consequences. Just one fascinating illustration. When some wise guy invented the stirrup, he changed the face of modern Europe. Up until about the 12th century, men rode horses long before that, but they had no stirrups. You can see in the old woodcuts and etchings, their feet just hung down. They hung onto the saddle or the lines, but they didn't have stirrups. Then it seemed to somebody sometime that if you had your feet anchored in something, A, you were a good deal safer. You could accomplish much more on horseback, carry a larger load, be more agile, and not be knocked off so easily. So, when the first Western cavalry was equipped with stirrups, a much heavier load, including big axes, those wonderful beheading instruments that you see in museums, axes and maces and big long spears could be carried. So, behold, they did. They made them. And the enemy then had to make armor to protect themselves from the heavier armament that could be carried by a man on a stirruped horse. And in order to make the armor, they had to invent a much more efficient process of making hardened metal. And in order to make the hardened metal, they had to get charcoal. And in order to get enough charcoal, as Trevelyan tells us in his History of England, they virtually deforested England. So that the that vast change in the economy of England, with the large parts of deforestation of England, France, and Germany, consequent upon the new demand for steel for armor. It all came from that confounded stirrup cup. So that Bolden White is a man who's written fascinating articles about various inventions, happenstances, which had unexpected consequences. All right. Now, those are his credentials. He wrote an article called the religious basis of our environmental crisis. And his argument in that little essay is as follows, that the heaviest responsibility for the insane way in which man is assaulting the environment and using the gifts of nature, that the heaviest burden of responsibility lies exactly on the Christian community. Well, that was a startling charge. And of course, I read it with startling interest. And in the essay is a very impressive marshaling of arguments. And the argument goes as follows. He says that the Bible, particularly the story of the creation, has been one of the primary educational powers in the formation of the Western intelligence, sensibility, and the creation of Western civilization. And a fundamental statement in that story, and you know that story prevailed whether people were literate or not, and for hundreds of years most were not, but it was a story told in preaching, in teaching, in catechesis, in stained glass windows, which are, as Henry Adams says, the picture books for the medieval illiterate. These marvelous stained glass windows were not just to be pretty. They were picture books for people who couldn't read to tell them the gospel story, the Old Testament story. A fundamental element in the story of creation is that man created God and put him into the garden and, according to the Latin translation, said he is to have dominium terrae, dominion over the earth. Now, that Latin translation, of course, was the translation available, and it came into our English Bibles as man is to have dominion over the garden, or the fruits of the earth, the animals, the waters, everything God has made. He placed man there to have dominion. Now, Latin dominion does not necessarily mean domination, but the impetus of the word, the momentum of the word, is exactly in the direction of exercise, lordship, domination. Do with it what your desires or your programs intend. Now, I'm sure White is right about that, that the influence of that notion that man is put in the garden, and remember, the garden is but a Hebrew image for the whole earth. He's placed in the middle of God's creation. The reading this morning said God settled him there. He put him there and said, go to town with it, as it were. Do with it what you can, or what you want, or whatever possibilities present themselves to you. Now, I was fascinated by that, and I sought the opinion of my betters in Old Testament philology, and found out that the Hebrew word doesn't mean that. The Hebrew word, translated by the Vulgate as dominium, means to hold a thing in its proper order, to keep it in its proper place. Now, why does God say that in the Genesis story to Israel, his called people? Because they lived in the midst of Canaanites. And the surrounding Canaanitish culture was a nature religion. God wanted to say, nature is God's, but it is not God. You are to keep nature in the order God gave it. It is a creature of God's. It is your fellow creature. You have a sibling relationship to nature. You are not to worship nature. You are to care for and use and deal with nature according to the order of the creation that God gives it. But unhappily, that notion of care, intelligent use, love, that becomes almost completely evaporated in the dominium terrae, which becomes the English domination. Now, Lynn White makes that whole argument, spells it out. Unhappily, or perhaps happily, maybe he did not know, because he does not appeal to the enormous influence of that idea of man's domination over the world, he doesn't appeal to the enormous influence of that in the development of American culture. Some of you here come from Pittsburgh. Out of Pittsburgh came one of the great prophetic voices of American industrialism, Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie used to go up and down the world, the United States at least, not only endowing libraries in East Burlap, but he endowed libraries and also made speeches. And the main speech of Andrew Carnegie, and you can read it in his biographies, the main speech is that the principal evidence of a devout man's worship of God is the prosperity that God gives him for his ingenious use of the creation. That if you want to be sure you're saved, look at your bank account. If you've prospered, that means God smiles upon your operations. And how God must have laughed out loud at the operations of Andrew Carnegie. That is this connection between technological, inventive, ingenious productivity, the connection between that and the service of God became a very powerful notion in our American culture. So that you put together the notion that God intended us to slap the world around in whatever shape we thought right, you put that together with the devout, largely Calvinist notion that there is an interior relationship between election and prosperity, or the divine favor and the evidences of divine favor in prosperity, and you get an absolute theology for rampant capitalism. Not only a theological apologia for capitalism in all of its forms, but you also get an interior penitential psalm for successful capitalism. So that not only the Christian tradition, in its unhappy use of the Genesis story, but the fusion of that with the powerful Western tradition of the uses of the world, is another component that I want to put open the table for our discussion, and tomorrow try to bring them together. Kathy, how long have I got? Well, we have discussion until 11:30. Well, I don't want to take it all, so I'll just put one more thing on the table. in scrounging through the Christian tradition as such, and the Lutheran tradition in particular, I came across some other interesting relations and data. Let me just touch them and pass on. You can go into this for yourself. Probably the most influential theologian in the history of the Western Church has been St. Augustine. And my own debt to St. Augustine is so huge that I hesitate to point out the one place where I have problems with it. St. Augustine begins the briefest theological statement he ever made, a kind of catechism, by saying, the subject and the object of theology are as follows: God and the soul. God and the soul. These two foci. Between these, all thought about God takes place. I need not point out to you the radically unsociological nature of that structure of thinking. God and the individual soul, these two. So that you read the confessions, which many of you in courses in Western literature have been asked to read, I'm sure. You read the confessions of St. Augustine. They could have been written by a man living in absolute solitude on an island with only reports of other people. Myself and God, the self and the self's Lord. This is the axis upon which Augustine spins out the confession. Now, actually, the God relationship is not constituted just by a naked integer called the soul, or the spirit, or the self, or the single identity. The realm of theological reflection, as all other reflection, is God and man and the world, including, very importantly, the whole fellow man world. So that all of our transactions are theological, anthropological, and sociological. And when you develop each of these far enough, you get economical, political, psychological, all the other realms of discourse, even aesthetic. So that the powerful influence of Augustine for almost 1,000 years in the development of Western Catholicism, including Luther, led to this kind of God and the soul as the axis for theological reflection. Now, I would suggest, to continue this, that Luther really knew better. And Luther is one of those figures who had a sense for what we would call the sociology of religion. He would have made short work, usually profanely, of that kind of language. But he had a sense for the fact of the profundity with which all relationships are infiltrated by social realities, social relationships. But in the period of the Enlightenment, to try to build up the components for our present catastrophic attitude, what is the inheritance of the Enlightenment for the religious mind? Now, the inheritance for philosophy, for engineering, pure science, physics, the inheritance is enormous. But I want to fasten down on what did the Enlightenment do to the religious sensibility? Of course, that could be a quarter's course. But let's point to the most obvious thing. Bacon, one of the most eloquent children of the Enlightenment, said, "Let us now lay aside the feckless speculations of theologians and gaze steadfastly at things." Well, now, after some hundreds of years of gazing steadfastly at things, we don't have the same messianic hope about that Bacon had. But the point is a powerful one. What he said is, quit trying to account for certain things that happen by looking into the scriptures or reading Thomas Aquinas or Aristotle. Just take the thing and look at it. Watch it, experiment with it, take it apart, put it together, watch it in its natural habitat, or put it under the microscope if you can, and soon there was one, or look at stars with a telescope. Peer steadfastly at things. That's the foundational stone of modern science, empirical method. And the goods of that I need not spell out. But religiously, what does this mean? I think it has meant that as we peered steadfastly at things, we were both encouraged by the Enlightenment and repaid by contemporary scientific procedures for an absolutely empirical attitude toward reality. Reality is what things are in their structure, or what they do in their function. What is thought? I once passed in the quadrangles at the University of Chicago. I passed a friend of mine who's a neurosurgeon. And I said to this man, "Bill, what do we think with?" He said, "That's a typical Lance question. I see you coming out of the divinity school. You would think of a thing like that." "Yeah, I'm very serious. What do you think with? What do you think with your brains?" he said. "Of course." That is no answer at all. "I know that the brains are a component of what we call reflection or thought. But what makes my brain think? What goes on up there?" "Oh, hell, we don't know that," he said. "Well," I said, "are you interested in that?" "Oh, we're fascinated by it." But he said, very likely, what you call reflection is probably the same thing that they do in pathology and in hematology when they're always fussing around with the interior chemical structure of molecules." So he said, "Thought is chemical." Well, I suppose he's right. I mean, in the sense that without this chemical business, you wouldn't have a brain that produces what you call ideas or thoughts. But, of course, has nothing to do with what my question was. Why do I think of one thing rather than another? Why, having thought of a certain thing, why do I say it is beautiful, and why then do I want to ask, why is it beautiful and not beautiful? What are the components of that which I call the beautiful? What is the emotional quality of the beholding of beauty? How is beauty related to sanctity, holiness, reverence? That kind of stuff I don't think is chemistry. Though I know that without chemistry it wouldn't be. So that the deposit of the Enlightenment upon modern Christian faith has been what one might call a desacralization of the world. A desacralization, a denuding of the world of the possibility of being beheld as a transparency to the Creator, to something, some fountain from which it comes, or some road upon which it is embarked, or some end, including us, which the Creator might have intended. So I think the empiricizing of mentation by virtue of the Enlightenment discipline has made it possible for a contemporary good Lutheran to go out and look at those woods, you know, and say, "I wonder how many two befores I can get out of," as the fundamental statement about woods. Now to go back to where I began and conclude this morning's admittedly wandering operation. If a man looks at woods, or now in these days of liberation, a woman, because she can be just as empirical and rapacious as men can. What are the ways of looking at a woods? Our whole culture tilts us in the direction of looking at the woods in terms of its economic material possibility. What kind of transactions can I carry on with it, or procedures whereby to turn it into something other than it now is, or to some end or to some purpose? Now, to be sure, the use of the earth is not against the will of God. You are to tend the earth. Tend obviously means you grow things, pen things, work with things, and use things. But this notion of rapacity toward the world, which I've tried to elaborate, let me play over again to the final word, a beautiful little poem, which I also learned from that blessed woman back in grade school and high school, who sensitized me to the allure of language. There's a little poem by Walter de la Mare. Some of you may know it. And on these last days of February, just on the edge of March, it's a very appropriate one. It's simple as it can be. Very old are the woods and the buds that break out of the briar's boughs when March winds wake. So old with their beauty are, oh, no man knows through what wild centuries roves back the rose. Very old are the brooks and the rills that rise where snow sleeps cold beneath the azure skies. Sing such a history of come and gone, their every drop is wise as Solomon. Very old are we men, our dreams, our tales, told in dim Edens by Eve's nightingales. We wake and whisper a while, till the day gone by, silence and sleep like fields of amaranth lie. Now what the poem reflect is a man looking at the woods and the rose and asking, whence has all this come? What's going on here? Sing such a history of come and gone. That is, the woods become for him a kind of massive parable of the ultimate mystery of human life, and longevity, and memory, and history. Now that we should have lost so much of this capacity, I think Lynn White is quite right when he lays a large part of that at the door of the church. I could enter here a refutation of Lynn White and point out that places where the Christian tradition is unknown are just as stupid in their dealing with the earth as the West is sometimes. Lake Baikal and the communists are hardly confessing Lutherans, but I forbear that effort. But he has a good deal in the argument which is uncomfortably true. Now to go from there to how should we, or you really, I'm too old. My generation is not going to do a damn thing about it except buy more gas for 8 cylinders. I'm convinced. On the whole, we're going to run the lights, run the air conditioners, buy electric toothbrushes and electric hair dryers, and keep right on grabbing for more and more energy to do not only useful things and necessary things, but all the other things which are neither useful nor necessary. I'm sure of that. But there is a chance that the student revolt, which is now sanctified by history, that you may have a profounder, longer-lasting, stupor revolt still in your bag, and that you help to bring it all. Thank you very much.